Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We have breaking news. A new report on the Woolsey fire of just over a year ago is now out. Now, the Woolsey fire, if you're like me, I was a little confused. Which big one was that? We had so many that came in close succession. So the Woolsey is the one that did so much damage to Malibu, that burned down to Pacific Coast Highway, even crossed the highway in some places. Many homes and structures in the Point Dume area were destroyed or heavily damaged. Residents were out of their home for days. Total of more than 1,600 structures were destroyed, three people were killed, and nearly 300,000 residents were evacuated in this fire, which began in the Santa Susana Mountains, burned to the south and to the west. It began November 8th of last year, and it took 2 weeks for that fire to be fully contained. Now the report is out to talk about how the fire response was, what things could be learned from that devastating fire. And joining us is Director of the Office of Emergency Management for the Los Angeles County Chief Executive Office, Kevin McGowan. Mr. McGowan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity, Larry.
So I know this report has just come out, but let's talk first about some of the challenges for first responders in this fire. What have we learned from the report?
Yes, thank you again for the opportunity. The report really highlights how catastrophic this event really was. It was unprecedented in nature. It traveled faster than fires that we traditionally see. And I think the report does an important part of identifying that this wasn't a traditional brush fire, that this really was a natural disaster, that it culminated with all of these factors lining up, very dry conditions, extreme weather behavior, and then multiple fires that were already impacting our state, which impacted the ability for resources to be available to really get a handle on this fire. And then what transpired was a catastrophic event in the Santa Monica Mountains and Malibu corridor.
Well, and you mentioned other fires. This is, of course, at the same time, you've got the Camp Fire in Northern California that was burning at that time, which, of course, destroyed the town of Paradise and killed so many people there. And on this very same day that the Woolsey Fire started, the Hill Fire began earlier. And so did fire resources went there first?
Yes. So when the Hill Fire occurred, there were mutual aid requests from the Ventura County Fire Department, which resources from our region were supporting. And then the Woolsey Fire occurred shortly thereafter. So there were definitely resources that were initially deployed to the Hill Fire. There was immediate life safety and structure protection needs for that fire. And then subsequently the Woolsey Fire.
Okay. So once firefighters realized how quickly Woolsey was spreading, jumping the Ventura Freeway and burning up into the Santa Monica Mountains, what were the challenges in the large-scale evacuations, particularly when residents were reliant on just a few canyon roads?
So the report identifies that there are basically three large themes for these challenges, and they are communication, collaboration, and situational awareness. And when we're speaking about the evacuation, that really all three of these areas impacted the evacuation. So you have this very fast-moving fire that's impacting a very large geographical area, and it really resulted in evacuation corridors that were very limited, utilizing the Pacific Coast Highway and then maybe one or two canyon roads, depending on what point in time that event occurred. So communications were impacted. Infrastructure started being lost by the fire impacts, but then also because of wind. So our ability to notify the public and then communicate and coordinate internally were all hampered by this event. And it really required our ability to overcome and adapt and create solutions during the action planning stage to then implement. And the result was the evacuation of over 300,000 approximately 300,000 people in that corridor.
Now, take us back a year ago to the evacuations. Were most of those accomplished using a reverse kind of 911 or using smartphone alert systems to tell people to leave, or officers going driving down streets with their sound systems to tell people to go? What seemed to be the most effective way to get people out?
So it was really a combination of all of those. When you're talking about emergency notifications or alert and warning, there's really no one tool that's the best tool. You really have to leverage all of the tools within your arsenal to effectively communicate. The report identifies that some of the more effective tools that were utilized during this, we had a substantial in-person notification process that, you know, traditionally we call door knocks. That was utilized in all of our evacuation areas substantially. But then the report also identifies that we have areas of improvement in our use of some of the electronic tools, so wireless emergency alerts and the emergency alert system. But all of the tools were utilized. The report just identifies the need for us to maximize or optimize certain tools over others.
We're talking with Los Angeles County's Director of the Office of Emergency Management, Kevin McGowan, filling us in on the report released just minutes ago, which investigated how the Woolsey fire was responded to, the devastating fire, which, you know, thankfully, there were only three lives that were lost. As tragic as that is, the loss of life could have been just absolutely devastating, because so many homes destroyed, and the fire moved very, very quickly through that area just over or just about a year ago. If you have questions for Mr. McGowan about the report, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. What about the ability of multiple agencies to communicate? L.A. City Fire, County Fire officials, Ventura County Fire, Highway Patrol, Sheriff's Departments. I mean, how were they all able to effectively and quickly communicate amongst themselves?
Yes, so we operated within the construct that we call Unified Command. So all of those different agencies that have jurisdictional responsibilities are a part of that command structure. And within that command structure, there are processes in how we communicate. One of the challenges with communication is understanding the situation that is unfolding. And really, that's where we see the need for additional ability to become more aware of the situation as it's unfolding, and then how we communicate those priorities and issues through that structure. So I just really want to emphasize, within Los Angeles County, we are practitioners on all scales of disasters in Unified Command. We train in Unified Command and we implement Unified Command. And it's one of the successes of the Woolsey Fire was how we used a very complex multi-jurisdictional area where a fire was didn't see boundaries, right? The fire was in multiple counties in impacting multiple cities. And really what was used to overcome that challenge was this unified command.
And that worked as intended. What's learned for the future then about alerting residents and evacuation? What does this after action review have that can now be implemented?
That we have to alert, warn, and notify the public with clear, concise messages in a timely manner. These fires are burning at unprecedented rates, and we have to be as fast as those disasters are occurring in clear, concise messages.
Okay. Was the water supply sufficient? Or I know many times in hillside mountainous areas, there's just not enough pressure nor enough hydrants, and the water drops take time to get those planes loaded and airborne. Was that an issue here?
No, the report does not identify that as a significant issue.
Okay. I want to thank you so much, Kevin McGowan, for being with us, Los Angeles County Chief Executive Offices, where he's Director of the Office of Emergency Management. There'll be additional reporting throughout the day on the Woolsey Fire After Action Review, just released just about a year later. The biggest challenges for first responders, for helping residents deal with evacuation, with limited ingress and egress, and also the length of time it took to get utilities back up and serving those communities. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. One of the biggest challenges for law enforcement is to determine someone is under the influence of THC, the active ingredient in cannabis. Tests run the risk of detecting THC even a long time after someone has used marijuana and wouldn't necessarily have their driving affected by it. But now there is technology being developed in breathalyzer form, which purports to be able to determine whether someone has recently consumed THC. Joining us to talk about this, some of the legal issues and the challenges involved, Amanda Chicago Lewis, freelance journalist who covers the cannabis industry. Her latest piece was for the New York Times, titled CBD or THC, Common Drug Test Can't Tell the Difference. Amanda, good to have you with us again.
Great to be here.
So first of all, it would seem that this would be a breakthrough if you could come up with a breathalyzer to determine THC alone and recency of use.
It would seem that way, but I will tell you that businesses have been promising a marijuana breathalyzer for years, and it's sort of a magic bullet, and it's not something that I think quite exists yet. I'm very skeptical of it, and my conversations with the people who've studied this at the National Institute of Drug Abuse have convinced me that the technology might be impossible.
And what is the challenge? Is it just that THC on the breath isn't like alcohol where it's readily evident?
Right. Alcohol is water soluble and THC is fat soluble. So it gets stored in the body and could stay there for weeks. And the best test we have is in saliva. It stays in saliva for about 3 days, but that's not going to tell you whether someone is acutely stoned, because obviously if you smoke a joint, you're not stoned for 3 days.
You also point out in this recent New York Times piece that even some of the tests that are out there that are designed to be more effective were showing up with CBD, which is the non-psychoactive part of cannabis, instead of THC?
Right. So the New York Times article was about a separate issue, which is about drug testing. So bizarrely in this country, drug testing laboratories develop other methodologies in-house. So we don't really have any great way to know how many labs are doing this. But there is a specific method of drug testing that cannot tell the difference between THC, which is federally illegal, and CBD, which is federally legal after the Farm Bill passed in December.
So, and is sold all over the place as touted as a health additive.
Absolutely, yes. And, this testing around cannabis has become incredibly problematic, especially with these CBD products in the marketplace, because lots of these CBD products contain THC, and that could also cause a false positive for people who think that they're taking legal products.
What about the issue of doing blood testing and things like that? Is that done currently by law enforcement if an officer suspects a driver's under the influence?
Yes. Currently, law enforcement will either take you back to do a blood test in a lab, or they'll do a swab of your cheek and do a saliva test. But again, neither of those tests will be able to tell if you are actually stoned in that moment and intoxicated, which makes the whole process very troubling and means that maybe we're having enforcement on people who are not actually intoxicated.
What about edibles versus smoking of cannabis? Does that, in the way it's metabolized, affect test results?
Yeah, metabolizing cannabis through your liver, which is what happens when you have an edible, is different from smoking and is one of the many reasons why I'm extremely skeptical of any marijuana breathalyzer.
All right. We're joined by journalist Amanda Chicago Lewis, also with us is Noah Debrincat, who's the co-founder and CEO of Santech Labs, which is a Canadian company developing a breathalyzer device for cannabis. Thank you, sir, for being with us. So we've just heard from Amanda Chicago Lewis some of the challenges here. How is your company attempting to deal with those challenges?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Larry. And Amanda, definitely sounds like you've done your research. The challenges that Amanda spoke about are very real. And the bottom line is our background in nanotechnology engineering means that we're set up to take this scientific lab-based approach to actually solving this problem. So things like in-house testing and having people out there hold us to high standards with these products will make sure that once we actually do release the product, we're not going to be seeing those false positives and false negatives that you do currently see today.
And how close is your product to being able to do a test to determine its accuracy?
So we're actively testing people in our lab facilities today. The bigger question is, you know, when can we deploy these outside of our labs? We're targeting the end of 2020 to be able to have something out for people to test for real, like in the field. That's kind of where we're at.
And is this blind so that as in your testing, you don't necessarily know who has consumed or smoked cannabis with THC within, say, 3 hours and who hasn't? Or is this not a blind study?
There's different studies that we're running, and for certain reasons we will do blind studies, and for certain other reasons we will do non-blind studies. But when we actually publish the results of our device and our technology, they will need to be with that blind.
What are the challenges you're experiencing as you test the product now?
Yeah, I think by far anybody in this space understands that edibles is a big challenge, and that's something that we're working on every single day.
Do edibles show up in breath?
At this point, it's very, very small trace amounts.
Okay, so someone could consume large quantity of THC via edibles, and they wouldn't that wouldn't necessarily be detected on the breathalyzer test.
It's really hard to say at this point. I couldn't definitively say that, and to be honest, there needs to be more research conducted in order to actually prove that.
All right. And there are other companies that are working on this as well. You see a sort of a race to who can patent the technology first?
Not really. I think all of us are doing our best to get the product out. Hopefully everyone's motivations in the space is right. Nobody should be in a rush. Everybody should be working very hard to get the real accurate scientific evidence to prove the device. I think adding the context of racing each other just challenges whether or not the device will be legitimate. And so it's less of a race and more who can give the most accurate, most defensible product.
Amanda Chicago Lewis, what are some of the different approaches these companies are taking to try and solve this challenge?
I mean, I can't get into the details of the science, but honestly, what I've seen in the past is there's an enormous demand for this product. Right? The same people at the National Institute of Drug Abuse who told me when I wrote about this a couple of years ago that they didn't think it was really possible to have a marijuana breathalyzer told me that people who had marijuana in their system, so, you know, the 30 days after you use cannabis, were twice as likely to get into an auto accident. And that really alarmed me as a cannabis user and also as someone who lives in California and drives. So, if that's true, then we're in a sort of slippery slope situation, and who really knows what could happen there.
But it doesn't mean the cannabis is the cause of that, because
right,
that could be a self-selecting. Yeah, exactly.
For sure. That could definitely be correlation. But I think what we're talking about here is that, you know, we don't really know, and the need for a marijuana breathalyzer, the increased use of cannabis because of legalization is driving so many different researchers and companies to say they're developing a marijuana breathalyzer. Does one exist? Not yet. It's one of the many troubling ways that the industry and legalization is way far ahead of the science.
Yeah. Well, on the other side are the defense attorneys who are just licking their chops to be able to go after any vulnerability in any of these, even if law enforcement and district attorney's offices decide they're going to use them to prosecute.
Sure. But what I'm really more concerned about is someone like Sandra Bland, which is a name we all know, right? She was found to have cannabis in her system, and that was, you know, used to demonize her and used to, you know, explain why she might have hung herself in her cell or explain why she might have been pulled over by police when, you know, all other accounts of what happened with Sandra Bland seem to indicate that there was a situation of racial profiling that ended in someone's tragic death.
But people came back on that and said, you know, there's not a link between suicide and marijuana usage and all. So, I mean, certainly that's not the end of that conversation.
But the fact that the testing shows whether you've used cannabis any time in the past 30 days means that, you know, anytime law enforcement tests someone and finds cannabis in their system, they could use that to demonize them or to blame some kind of whatever happened with them.
Whatever behavior happened or accident.
Right.
So, Amanda, at this point, the training of officers to identify, who were called to the scene to try and identify someone under the influence, does that training seem to be sufficient for them to really identify someone under the influence?
Probably not. I mean, you know, certainly I'm not a member of the California Highway Patrol, but when I've spoken to people with the CHP, I think that they're, you know, really around cannabis looking for clear guidelines and clear rules. We've had really gray area legality around cannabis in California for the past 2+ decades. Things are just now starting to get under control. And a lot of law enforcement really just wants clarity. What's legal? What's not legal? What's okay? What's not okay? You know, we've put out guidelines on, well, you know, if you're stoned, time moves more slowly for you. So if you have someone count, you can maybe tell from that. But a lot of that stuff is really subjective. And I think that this is, you know, it's a troubling public safety issue that people could be stoned on the road. And it's a troubling law enforcement, criminal justice issue that we have no way to tell.
The challenge continues. Thanks so much. Appreciate your being with us again, Amanda. Thank
you. Great to be here.
Amanda Chicago Lewis, a freelance journalist, covers the cannabis industry. Her latest New York Times piece, CBD or THC? Common drug test can't tell the difference. And my thanks to Noah Debrincat, co-founder CEO of Santec Labs, Canadian company developing a breathalyzer test for cannabis. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. As I just mentioned, the Aliso Canyon gas leak was 4 years ago. And it was huge, more than 100,000 metric tons of methane and other chemicals leaked into the air for a combined period of 100 days over the course of 2015 and 2016. And our own Sharon McNary, infrastructure correspondent, who has been covering this story in the intervening 4 years, has put out a brand new in-depth look at the aftermath of Aliso Canyon at LAist.com. Sharon, good morning.
Good morning.
This continues to be a huge effect, as we just saw in the fire that, of course, led to 100,000 people being evacuated.
Yeah, the fire came streaming down over those mountains. You know, the gas field is not some abstraction. It's like, 6 square miles of the Santa Susana Mountains with oil wells, former oil wells, dotting it. And they've been turned into gas wells that push gas into the depleted oil field. And, the fire came out over that. And a piece of it, a little tiny 4x4 piece of it, like stubbornly burned, and they couldn't figure out, like, what is it? That we're still waiting to find out, like, what was burning, and that's probably just some oil left over from old oil operations, but who knows? It's a mountain of mystery to a lot of people.
And today is the actual 4-year anniversary, isn't it, where the leak was first detected?
First detected is a really good way to describe it, because people who live in that area don't actually know when the leak actually first started, but the fumes started permeating the area on the 23rd of October 2015. And it was 3 days before Southern California Gas Company, which owns that gas field, actually reported that they had a serious leak to authorities, and they actually ended up getting charged criminally on that and settled the charges.
So to this day, is it still unclear when the actual leaking started?
What we got this last year, and why I like to do these anniversary recaps, is in this past year, we learned more about the root cause of the disaster. We've learned more about the health effects of what came out of the hole. And there's still an ongoing whole bunch of investigations into the operation of the plant and whether it should be continued at full strength, whether it should be minimized or closed. Those are state investigations. So as far as the cause, what has been said in the root cause report done by an independent third party is that corrosion many hundreds of feet down where the pipe that comprises the well was not fully cemented, corroded from water getting in. And because they were moving gas in and out of that pipe, not through a center little tube, but through the center tube and the donut space around that tube, that aided the corrosion. And, you know, 40, 50 years later, the thing broke open.
What kind of pressure is that gas stored under?
It's amazing. You put 30 pounds of pressure of air per square inch into your car tires. This has 3,000 pounds per square inch. I mean, it's just a massive amount of pressure.
So even a little leak is going to spew a tremendous amount of natural gas.
If it can't be controlled. And one of the points that the root cause report made was that there had been similar leaks in the past, and the gas company had not sufficiently investigated them and reported into what the cause of those corrosions were. So, I mean, the Southern California Gas Company would like to describe this as an industrial accident, but the root cause report made it clear that there was a lot they could have done to detect the leak and prevent it. They didn't really have a plan for dealing with a leak of that magnitude because the way they went at stopping the leak was ineffective.
Can they put cameras down all of those pipes to see if there's corrosion, or is that not possible because the amount of pressure that's being held in there, you just can't get a camera down there?
I know a lot more about oil and gas wells than I did 4 years ago.
I know you do, because you amaze me every time.
But it's not really a camera. It's what they'll do is they'll seal off the well, and they'll put pressure into the well, and they'll take temperatures in the well, and where the temperature drops, that will show that there might be some anomaly in the thickness of the well casing.
And have they gone back and retrofitted the ones that are corroded?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this gas field has been completely worked over since then.
But at the same time, residents are still concerned. They want to see it closed despite that renovation of the field.
Well, and I'll tell you why. Just this last July, there was a report out of the Fielding School of Public Health at UCLA. And that report was like looking at like what are the real things that are existing in the air, on the soil, on the surfaces of people's homes that might account for all of the illnesses that people have been reporting. You know, sometimes when people go back into a disaster area, they're going to have some PTSD. They're going to have some psychosomatic symptoms. The UCLA study, and I talked to its author yesterday, was trying to figure out what is actually there that could account for like nosebleeds and respiratory problems, leukemias, blood diseases. And things like benzene, for which there is no safe level, they were detecting.
And all of that's so challenging, as you know, trying to determine that sort of highly localized physical response to being exposed to these chemicals. It's very difficult.
Very difficult. And there's another local doctor who's supposed to roll out his results later this month. His name's Jeffrey Nordella. He's been going around doing toxicological testing, you know, blood panels for people. And that's actually pretty controversial because during the blowout and in the immediate aftermath, Los Angeles County was actually advising doctors not to rely on blood work because, you know, it's not the kind of methodology that a large-scale public health study would do. But people want to know what's in my blood. And so it's a very attractive thing for people to do. So it's controversial. That's something we're going to see in the coming year talked about.
And I'm sure the lawsuits, even though we're 4 years out, there's still plenty of them being litigated.
Yeah, there were 48,000 plaintiffs about 6 months ago. Now they've gotten rid of duplicates, and people who have not followed up on their lawsuits have dropped out. There's about 38,000 plaintiffs. In the coming year, we might be seeing the first of those come to trial.
We're talking with KPCC infrastructure correspondent Sharon McNary. She's been spending the past 4 years reporting on Aliso Canyon and the massive gas leak that covered months in 2015 and 2016, combined period of 100 days and evacuations that lasted for months for the residents there. Sharon, if Aliso Canyon was to be closed, and you didn't decrease the consumption of natural gas, so demand stayed the same, are there other places to put that gas? What is the risk if you were to just close it and not keep the gas there?
You know, there are other major metropolitan areas that don't store gas underground because they don't have, you know, the empty salt domes or the aquifers or the depleted oil fields to store it underground. And they store their gas in pipelines. And they've actually been built up with like larger diameter pipelines so that the underground pipelines double as storage. Here in LA, we had the luxury of always having this supply of gas underground to draw it from, at least since about the Second World War is when they started it in Playa del Rey. If all of the gas fields were closed in our area, we would have to be extremely careful in how we use gas. We'd have to use only exactly as much as we had ordered the day before.
Well, and I assume you'd know better than me, but there's more risk if you've got a bigger pipe that's feeding communities if there's a leak in that pipe, right? Because you're taking the gas right into residential neighborhoods and business areas.
We do know that the pipes up in Northern California where they had the San Bruno explosion was a bigger pipe, but I'm not sure that
there's a bigger risk because the pipe's bigger. Okay,
risk, yeah.
All right. Sharon, thank you so much. Your full reporting is at LAist.com. You'll see her report on the 4-year anniversary. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. Hope you're having a good morning. In the midst of a divorce, freshman Democratic member of Congress Katie Hill of the Antelope Valley and surrounding communities has had several claims about her personal life that have been made at redstate.org, a conservative site. The claim involves that Hill allegedly had a romantic relationship with her legislative director. Having a relationship with a staffer in Congress, it was banned as a result of new rules that were passed earlier this year in the House of Representatives. After the publication in Red State, Congresswoman Hill responded with a statement. She sent this to us. It reads, "Intimate photos of me and another individual were published by Republican operatives on the internet without my consent. I have notified Capitol Hill police who are investigating the situation and potential legal violations of those who posted and distributed the photos, and therefore will have no further comment on the digital materials. The fact is, I'm going through a divorce from an abusive husband who seems determined to try to humiliate me. I am disgusted that my opponents would seek to exploit such a private matter for political gain. This coordinated effort to try to destroy me and people close to me is despicable and will not succeed. I, like many women who have faced attacks like this before, am stronger than those who want me to be afraid. Allegations that I have been involved in a relationship with Mr. Kelly are absolutely false. I am saddened that the deeply personal matter of my divorce has been brought into public view, and the vindictive claims of my ex have now involved the lives and reputations of unrelated parties. This smear campaign will not get in the way of the work I am doing every day to move our district and our country forward. I am truly grateful for the outpouring of support I have received from colleagues and constituents alike, and I know we will get through this together. onward. Joining us is Congressional Bureau Chief for Politico, John Bresnahan. John, thank you for joining us. So what do we know about the potential investigation into the release of these photographs, as well as the claim that the Katie Hill denies that there was a personal relationship with a staffer?
Well, as you noted, this is a shocking episode, and the allegations are very serious. Right now, the U.S. Capitol Police are looking into the allegations or into the how this photo surfaced. And they are investigating. The U.S. Capitol Police is actually a large police force, and they're pretty sophisticated. They're actually as big a police force as the city of Cleveland. And they have some cybersecurity element, and they also work with the FBI and other federal agencies. So they're looking into this because, of course, revenge porn, so-called revenge porn, is illegal. Posting that and disseminating it is illegal. So they're looking into that. Now, the allegations that the congresswoman is had a relationship with a staffer, now, a congressional staffer, that, of course, would be improper. That would be a violation of ethics rules if it did occur. She says it has not happened. There is no evidence that it's happened as far as we can tell. But I think this will probably be something that gets further scrutiny down the line. It's too early to tell right now. But just in the wake of, you know, repeated congressional scandals on in terms of interaction between members and staff, over the years, they'll probably look into this.
I can't remember a similar circumstance where you have a member of Congress who has allegedly been targeted as part of a divorce action in such a personal way. In the years that you've been covering this, John, do you recall anything like this?
I do. Not quite these circumstances, but there have, over the years, there have been scandals, sex scandals that have come out of divorces. I remember, or relationships that have gone bad. There was a congressman named Don Sherwood. He was a Republican. He had allegedly choked his mistress, and he paid her off. And that came out when she didn't get... when they broke up, she put that information out. There was also in the 80s, there were sex scandals on this. I mean, so there have been various, there's been bad divorces that have spilled over into politics. I remember one congressman from Maryland, Al Wynn, a Democrat, his wife actually cut robocalls for his opponent because she was so angry.
Wow.
So there's been over the years, these, you know, this has occurred, but again, to see a photo like this is shocking. And then we are talking about a freshman member, a historic member, in a sense, she's identifies as bisexual. And the allegations, there was two relationships she's alleged to have had, according to these stories, one with a campaign staffer, and that also involved her husband, who is there in the middle of a divorce proceeding. And then there's a separate allegation with a concurrent congressional staffer. So, I mean, this is very serious stuff. It's ugly stuff. Divorce proceedings can often get ugly, as we all know. We've seen it in families or friends or people have experienced it themselves.
Yeah, and I guess I wonder if, you know, this kind of stuff matters to your constituents or just feel like this is deeply unfair for her to have to go through this. Let me bring into the conversation to talk about the ethics of how this is covered, what Red State did with publishing the intimate photos, as well as a series of texts that are purported to be between the congresswoman and someone she's involved with. Jane Kirtley, professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Professor, good to have you with us again. Obviously, we're in a whole new social media age where people can do this type of stuff and try and harm someone else. What's media's responsibility in your view?
I think the toughest thing about this, at least to begin with, is trying to verify whether there's any basis for the allegations. I can't take a position on this particular case, but I guess what I would say is that journalists have an obligation, ethical obligation, and probably a legal one, too, to make an attempt to verify that what they're seeing is what it purports to be. In this era of deep fake technology, Photoshop, things like that, it is really possible for people to fabricate photographs and pass them off as something that they aren't, or even to take a true photograph out of context. You mentioned the issue of revenge porn. I mean, there's a reason that 46 states and the District of Columbia have various kinds of laws criminalizing this, and I think we have to stop and think. Yes, journalists are not bound, for example, by the laws of evidence that would be presented in a court of law, but surely we have some obligation to verify that what we're passing along to people, we've at least made an attempt to verify the source and as best we can to verify whether the allegations have any kind of basis. Again, I can't take a position in this particular case. It does seem to me that, as was mentioned earlier, it's not that this is a new issue. It's just that it's a new issue in the context of new media. For me, the fundamental question beyond what I already said is how important is this likely to be to the constituents for this particular representative? I think, you know, it's tough to respond to that question because different people are going to respond in different ways. One of the things I always ask is this someone who has sought election based on family values, follow conventional wisdom, that kind of thing. Is that the basis? It doesn't really sound like it to me, given that this congresswoman has, you know, openly presented herself as bisexual and so forth. On the other hand, I think anything that's going to spark a congressional ethics investigation, if it's important enough for them to pursue the investigation, then people need to know about it.
All right. And I also wonder about, you know, the fact this came out in a publication or online website that has a particular political bent. Should that affect how it's dealt with in so-called mainstream media?
Well, I think one of the issues that always arises in these cases is that if the mainstream media don't report it, they get accused by those on a particular political viewpoint of censoring the news. I've seen that many, many times, and I'm sure you have too. I don't think it's censoring the news to not jettison your journalistic standards before you report something. I mean, that's what led to the whole Pizzagate discussion, where totally, you know, spurious allegations were being made and took on a veneer of legitimacy because the mainstream media were publishing it. You know, I don't know what Red State's vetting process is to try to determine the accuracy of these photographs. I would hope that they would be using journalistic that would say, you know, we've got to check it out before we report it.
And you mentioned in the Congresswoman's statement, she indicates these were intimate photos. We'll continue with Jane Kirtley of the University of Minnesota. Our thanks to John Bresnahan of Politico. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. So I'd like to hear from you as an Air Talk listener what you think of the ethical issue, how a story like this should be dealt, and how should the whole thing be handled in your view. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. I have to admit, it's difficult to see someone's contentious divorce play out publicly, and we're talking about the case in which a freshman member of Congress, Katie Hill of the Antelope Valley area, is having to deal with this. She's put out a statement in regard to a couple of photos, intimate photos that were published on a conservative website, Red State, as well as allegations about her personal life. And she has denied that she is engaged or was engaged in an affair with a congressional staff members of hers, which would be a violation of House rules. My question is, how do we deal with this? How do we deal with someone's private life being put out there visually like this? And is this something that news media really should not be talking about at all, since there is an allegation, unsubstantiated, of a relationship that would be a violation of House rules? Should that be reported on or not? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Katie Hill is asking that there be a legal investigation into how the intimate photos made their way into the possession of the website that published them, although blurred. As we just heard from Politico's John Bresnahan, the overwhelming majority of states now have laws against revenge porn, that there's legal culpability for attempting to harm someone by releasing intimate photos without the individual's consent. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I'm joined by media ethicist and professor at the University of Minnesota School of Journalism and Mass Communication, law professor Jane Kirtley. Professor, it seems like we're only going to have more of these cases where, intimate aspects of a public figure's lives are put out there for consumption. And beyond revenge porn laws and things like that, are there other sorts of checks or controls that can be put on this?
Well, the short answer is you're sitting in California, which probably has some of the most robust privacy protection legislation in the country. I mean, yes, they've got a revenge porn law, but they've also got a lot of other laws that deal with the perception of violating somebody's right to keep their personal life private. So there are probably California laws that would be helpful in this case, but we also just have something very simple, like the issue of, for example, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. If somebody hacked into a computer, that would be a federal crime, not just a state offense. So there are any number of possible ways that this could be dealt with, this particular case. What, of course, worries me a little bit from my kind of journalist hat perspective is I'm wondering if, as this investigation heats up, the criminal investigation that was referred to earlier that apparently the Capitol Police are starting to conduct, is whether Red State is going to find itself facing a subpoena to try to determine who was the source of these photographs. Not because necessarily their acceptance of them would be a violation of the law, but because whoever sent them to them might have broken the law themselves and they'll want to find out who it was.
Also, these purported texts that Red State published, could that also potentially be a violation of the law?
Yes, there are a number of laws that deal with hacking into telephone, text conversations, so forth. So if you've got a situation where you can demonstrate that this was done, there's certainly federal law that deals with this, and there might be applicable state statutes as well. So, without even getting into the content of the material, there may have been a violation of the law simply if there was phone hacking involved.
All right, we're at 866-893-KPECC, a chance for you to share your thoughts about how to cover a story like this, which gets into someone's private life, that has led Congresswoman Katie Hill to issue her statement in which she denied she was involved in a romantic relationship with a member of her House staff, which also claims that she has been targeted by an abusive estranged husband, involving the intimate photos and other allegations about her personal life. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-KPECC, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. It's a chance for you to weigh in on this and the allegations. Allegations in terms of her personal romantic life, nothing having to do with the House. I just wonder, Jane, if people are going to care about this. Does this, particularly to Democrats who have been fairly open about how people choose to live their lives, gender identity, sexual identity, and the like, in terms of any, political response to this. Would you expect this would potentially be damaging to her or not?
I think it depends on her constituency and what their expectations are. I mean, some of them are probably very comfortable with, her statement about what her sexual orientation is and the nature of her marriage and things like that. Other people may consider it a disqualifier for public service. It's tough. And I mean, I've been doing this kind of work for a very long time. And I remember back when Gary Hart was seeking the nomination for President of the United States, compromising photos of him with a woman who was not his wife on a boat called the Monkey Business basically torpedoed his political career. So this is not a new issue. I think ultimately for me, and I can't speak for her constituents, the question is always going to be hypocrisy. Do you have somebody who is presenting themselves as one thing and conducting their private life in another way? Do you have someone who is legislating or supporting policies that discriminate against a particular group and acting in a way that basically is getting them a free pass from conduct that they are trying to prohibit for other people? To me, that's when it's relevant. But obviously, every voter has his or her own litmus test as to what's important in terms of qualifications or not. I mean, remember, I'm in Minnesota, and we face the controversy surrounding our Senator Al Franken, who resigned rather than to face an ethics investigation. So, I mean, this is a very charged issue, obviously, and while I don't have any idea about what is ultimately going on here in the broader sense, it certainly is an area of vulnerability for politicians where they can easily be attacked by their opponents.
Writing on the Air Talk page, Curtis Ann writes, this is the way right-wing conservative Republicans roll. They release unvetted, irrelevant, salacious dirt on opponents, knowing our news media, including NPR, will repeat unproven charges over and over again while taking cover within presenting both sides' justification. This is straight out of the Trump playbook, exactly what he's trying to do with Joe Biden. That's Curtis Ann writing on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. BB Steve writes, rags have been doing this for how many years now? National Enquirer comes to mind first. It's all fair game when in the spotlight. If Hill did not want the attention, she should have stayed away from the sexual gas burner. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Share with us your thoughts about this and whether you think that this is all fair game or not. We have John who says the private sex lives of politicians have been fair game for journalists since Gary Hill got caught having an extramarital affair. In fact, Katie Hill's situation, if true, is more egregious than the Hart situation because Hart's alleged conduct did not involve violations of the law and of congressional ethics rules. The only question, though, John, is what is the source of this? Where does this come from? And what are the motives of the person making the allegation? And Jane Kirtley, we just don't have access to that.
Well, we don't. I mean, I think we have to be a little careful about going too far down the road on motivations because, as you know, President Trump has been arguing that the whistleblower's motivations are critical, whereas others have argued, no, it's the nature of the allegations themselves. I think we have to be very clear about how we're going to parse these kinds of things. But I do agree that, for me, there's a distinction between something that's going to be triggering a House ethics inquiry versus something that is really a matter between, frankly, a divorcing couple and whoever else might be involved in their relationship.
Well, and you know, one of the things that's kind of strange here is, as you know, over many years in Congress, there have been relationships between elected officials and members of their staff, including some very prominent members of Congress who were known to engage in this. And, you know, it's only recently, as I understand it, that a rule was passed against what is alleged in this case.
That's right. I mean, it's part of the whole Me Too movement, and I think it had bipartisan support to have these kinds of ethics rules. And, you know, I guess I have to say that ethics rules need to be applied fairly and equitably, and you really don't get a pass, because it was consensual, for example. That's not the issue. Obviously, when you're dealing with these kinds of relationships, there's always an imbalance of power. That's just the reality. And I think rules like this are trying to address that.
Jane Kirtley, as always, we so appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule and talking with us on Air Talk.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. From the University of Minnesota, she's professor of media ethics and law at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication. You can share your comments about media coverage of this on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Again, the Congresswoman Katie Hill of Southern California denying that she has had a relationship with one of her members of her House staff. It's AirTalk on 89.3 KPECC. We so appreciate your support to AirTalk on KPCC. You're part of the most generous audience in all of public broadcasting. It means so much to us. Well, today the Trump administration filed suit to try and block California from using its cap and trade program internationally. The feds charged that the state exceeded its constitutional authority by joining with Quebec in a program to cut climate-damaging fossil fuel emissions. The suit has been filed in federal court here in California. It's the latest effort of the Trump administration to try and stop California's go-it-alone environmental plans. Joining us is Governor Gavin Newsom. Governor, thank you for being with us to respond to the lawsuit.
I appreciate it, and I hate that here we are again. I mean, just a couple weeks ago, we were dealing with the Trump administration's effort to eliminate our waiver under the Clean Air Act to establish our own tailpipe emissions, and here we are, yet another assault, not just on California, but Mother Nature, the environment, our economy, our public health, and now asserting an absurd argument that we don't have the right to partner with other jurisdictions around the world in advancing the same cause.
So what the argument in the lawsuit, as I understand it, is that this usurps federal power, that essentially California is conducting foreign policy in taking part in a climate agreement that includes a Canadian province, that international accords are strictly under federal jurisdiction. Your response to that?
Well, we believe it has no legal basis whatsoever. And I say that not lightly. I say that rather thoughtfully, that we have talked to all of our legal experts. They believe there's absolutely no basis for this assertion. The cap and trade program that exists in California goes back to 2006. Quebec joined our cap and trade program in January of 2014. They have their own parallel cap and trade program that conduct auctions. And all we're doing is linking the two and participating in parallel strategies. By no stretch of the imagination does that undermine America's foreign policy. We think it very much just establishes a framework of collaboration that is rather consistent with many other memorands of understanding and protocols that have been established.
Could you give us an example of another area where California enters into an international agreement with a Canadian province or Mexican state or something like that, and there's been no federal challenge to that?
Yeah, there's not, I can't establish the basis of that, and that, of course, will be part of our legal framework. But as it relates to engaging in trade and relating to issues associated with foreign offices and desks and memorandums of understanding with subnational governments, we've had them in hundreds of jurisdictions. We've done this memorandum of understanding, what we call an MOU under two, with over 220 jurisdictions around the world, representing 43% of the world economy, and it establishes protocols and procedures for collaboration and advancing our collective values and goals. And to the extent that there's a more of a formal framework with Quebec, it used to be with Ontario as well. They dropped out a number of years ago. We don't think it deviates significantly from those pre-existing frames.
With us is California Governor Gavin Newsom. He's responding to this morning's filing of a federal lawsuit here in California where federal administrators claim that California usurped federal authority in including in its cap and trade program the Canadian province of Quebec. Can you explain, Governor, how this works with Quebec, how California's cap and trade system intersects with Canada's?
Yeah, and I think for a lot of people, the predicate is what the heck is cap and trade? Sometimes we just sort of accept that we understand what it is, but it's basically establishing a price for permits to emit carbon. And the idea is you restrict those number of permits over a period of time each year, and that requires then or compels people either to spend more or to pollute less by innovating. There are about four fully functioning cap and trade programs around the world, from the European Union to province in China, as well as in Korea. The formal relationship with Quebec and Ontario was advancing our parallel goals to see if we can conduct a kind of auctions that link up in terms of our ability to trade these permits, trade investments that include affordable housing, rebates for zero emission vehicles, land preservation, planting trees, all these areas that are proceeds that we generate from the sale of these permits. $9.3 billion dollars has been advanced and paid since 2012 alone. And this just allows that market to spread beyond our borders and to allow us even more flexibility in terms of those investments.
So an example with Quebec would be that let's say a Southern California-based company could purchase credits from a company based in Quebec. Is that how that would work?
Yeah, broadly, and look at cross-pollinating investments and the application and implementation of projects as well. So it's a multi-complementary in that respect. Look, one shouldn't over-romanticize these partnerships. As I said, Ontario was originally a participant in this. They backed off. This is not necessarily novel, but I won't necessarily claim that it has great precedence. So all of us are working out the logistics of these things, but it's part of the spirit of collaboration, cooperation. It's the spirit that brought us the Kyoto Protocols, Paris Accords. And again, it's the spirit that contrasts us with the values that are emanating, not just the pollution in this country, but the powers that be are emanating a different value proposition. And so it's not just, as they say, an assault on California. It's consistent with the Trump administration's assault on the climate and all of our agreements around the rest of the world.
Is Quebec the only non-U.S. entity a part of the program?
It's formerly part of our cap and trade program. And again, that was established in 2014. And we've been eager to get other jurisdictions around the world to participate in this. And I think that's part and parcel of what the administration is trying to avoid. I wanted to jumpstart this. And I fear, frankly, this was also part of a conversation we were having 2 weeks ago at the United Nations when we were seeking in a very public forum these collaborations and partnerships. These guys are just seeking to disrupt all things coming from the state of California. And let me just say this, Larry, it has to be said. This is an assault on the American people, the likes of which we have never experienced. I appreciate all of the attention appropriately being placed on the Ukraine. $391 million, direct quid pro quo. There's no question that is an appropriate investigation. But what is missing in this is the assault on this state, California, and the American people that live in California. Across the board, billions and billions of dollars that have been placed at risk because of the Trump administration's war on this state. It is a remarkable moment in our history. The corruption, it's the only way to describe it, the corruption is rampant, and this is just part and parcel of the weaponization of the EPA and the DOJ attacking the great people of this state.
Well, you have to be heartened, though, from your perspective, that California has prevailed so frequently in court.
Yeah, look, the law is on our side, morality is on our side, ethics and decency and honor, and the people are on our side. We'll prevail. There's no question in my mind. It's just another example of the stakes at this moment in our history. And I just want to make this final point. This has been bipartisan. I applaud Governor Schwarzenegger for his efforts. He signed the original cap and trade bill. The history of our environmental movement in California goes back to Ronald Reagan, goes back to Richard Nixon and the Clean Air Act in 1970. This was a bipartisan space, and it'd be wonderful to find that space again. But right now, we have a president who's deviant from the norm, that will do everything to undermine our efforts, but we will indeed, as you suggest, prevail.
Governor, thank you for being with us again. As always, we appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Governor Gavin Newsom joining us on Air Talk, responding to this morning's filing of a federal lawsuit against California for its cap and trade program, including Quebec.